The world doesn't cease reminding me it doesn't want me to be a playwright. It couldn't be more clear and consistent in its communication. I have spoken about rejections many times in this space, and I keep talking about it because I know they have a cumulative effect on us. Like a river carving a canyon into the land, rejections can cut us, leaving scars. But this isn't only about rejection. It's also about the voices we hear, both internal and external, the literal and metaphorical voices telling us maybe we should consider doing something else. For years, I simply couldn't imagine ever stopping. I have said multiple times I might die of old age under a pile of unproduced plays. I have said I'm okay with that. I'm a playwright, and I'll continue to do what I do regardless of how the universe responds. But I don't know if I believe my own words anymore. Lately, I've been thinking about a playwright whose work I know and really like, and he decided to retire from playwriting. He wrote an announcement on his blog about stepping away from the theater, that he felt like it was time and that he just wasn't getting out of it what he wanted. And I read that a couple years ago and I just couldn't believe it. How could somebody just give this up? And then I recently read a speech made by another incredibly accomplished and respected playwright who felt like she needed to step away from theater because it felt harmful to her. These actions, these stepping away, it feels bewildering to me. I mean, I can't compare myself to them, these other playwrights who have achieved so much, and I, the eternally emerging playwright who simply wants to be seen and heard. I'm not chasing Pulitzers or Broadway or headlines and marquees. All I want is to write as a means to commune with others. It's pretty simple. But these others keep saying no in response. So what do I do with this information? Is it true that I shouldn't be a playwright because the world keeps saying it? What is true, anyway? Sorry, my undergrad philosophy degree rears its pretentious head from time to time. What has always helped me ignore the world's consistent rejection were all the stories of late bloomers, those who stuck with it through years of rejection only to find success later in life. But now I consider the definition of insanity. I got into this in the first place because my life felt empty, and for the most part, that emptiness has been filled with hope. Lately, I started to think about how much longer this hope can sustain me. I began to rethink those playwrights I watched step away from this thing we do. I started to count the years I've been at it, about 12, and the number of years since I finished grad school, 4.5. Do I really think I can keep this going? Become an old man with unproduced plays piling up all around me? No. Really, no. I can't. It'll be death by 1,000 cuts, and I'll only have myself to blame. So I started to consider giving myself an end date. And when I recorded this interview you're about to hear, I started to wonder if I could maintain the determination like Paula Vogel did. I don't know if that's possible for me. I'm not Paula Vogel. Then I got about this far into writing this opening. I was searching for an upbeat end, I swear I was. You know, something like, I want to encourage everybody to stick with it. There are too many untold stories to tell. But my heart wasn't in it, and I didn't know what else to say. And then yesterday I got a phone call. It was one of those phone calls we, the eternally emerging, dream of. It was a, we want to produce your play call. It was completely unexpected, and it literally saved me. There are still contracts to sign and announcements to be made, and who knows, it could fall apart for any of the reasons, but if I'm listening when the world tells me no, I have to start listening when it says yes. So here I am, at a point that could be the start of something sustaining, or it could simply be a moment for me. Either way, it's something, a chance to commune with others, to make a play. It's all I want. And now I want to tell every other writer who is standing on the precipice to take a step back and breathe. If you're in it for the same reasons I'm in it, don't give up. Let that pile of plays grow and don't stop trying. The only certainty is if you don't try, you won't succeed. But if you keep at it, there's hope. I am Brian James Polak, and you are listening to The Subtext, a podcast where one playwright talks to another about what lives beneath the surface of our writing and our lives. The Subtext is brought to you by American Theater Magazine, a publication from Theater Communications Group. On this episode, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, on this episode, I have a conversation with Paula Vogel. I've been doing this podcast for several years, and Paula was always one of my dream people to record with. I am so thankful to the Goodman Theater in Chicago for making this happen. Like I said, the Subtext has been going on for several years. If you're listening for the first time and you like hearing playwrights talk about things, well, you're in for a treat because there are a lot of episodes available for your binging needs. Find the archives on iTunes and Apple Podcasts or at American Theater's website. And you can reach back further to the early days when LA Stage Alliance produced the Subtext. There's a treasure trove of episodes to listen to. Okay, here we go. What do I even need to say about Paula Vogel? She won a Pulitzer for How I Learned to Drive, an Obie Award for Baltimore Waltz. She wrote one of the most stunning pieces of theater I have ever experienced with Indecent. She is so beloved. There are multiple awards named in her honor. She is, quite simply, a gift to the world of theater, and I will stop talking now so we can listen to Paula tell her story.
So one of the things that, you know, I grew up, I'm starting to talk about it more because I think people assume that because I was teaching at this Ivy League place, that I came from money. And I grew up under the poverty line, and my mother was a secretary. And she said to me, you're going to learn how to type so that if your husband ever walks out on you like mine did, you can pay the rent. So for the first, I mean, really until maybe I was 33 years old, I always did secretarial jobs, and I did temp jobs. I was a typist at this news station. That was one of my favorite temp jobs. For a period of time, I worked for the Department of the Navy with a top secret clearance. This is when I was 19.
Wow.
Down in D.C. During Vietnam.
Yeah.
That lasted maybe 6 months. You know, and I was also a factory worker, and I did, I packed houses for moving van companies. You know, it, whatever, like I think so many of us, I always did about three jobs to get through school. So somehow or other, I finished the undergrad while working three jobs, you know, and I was taking like five or six courses to get through, so per semester.
And as you're working as a typist or packing houses or whatever, are you a writer? Are you?
No, I never admitted that I was a writer back then.
But were you, without admitting it?
I probably. I think this is a something that I think a lot of women do. I loved theater. I was obsessed with theater. I didn't think I'd ever be able to do theater because I didn't know anybody in theater.
Right.
And no one in my family had ever gone to college before my brothers and I went. So I guess I didn't even think that it was possible. I was doing kind of like cabaret. I was writing lyrics. I was doing little takeoffs. Yeah. When I went to school, I did a musical version of Lord of the Flies called Lady of the Maggots, about how civilization breaks down in a women's college out of the, you know, presence of men. And I did a musical adaptation of The Hunchback of Notre Dame called The Beautiful Quasimodo. And I think I wanted back then to be a director, but I didn't know how to do it. I knew it didn't pay. I knew, you know, if I would have to do the 2 to 3 jobs I was doing to get my BA. And the other thing that was terrifying was I was terrified of acting.
Yeah.
Did not want to be on stage. I hated being on stage. And at that time, all of the directing programs basically made you take acting and made you audition as an actor.
So where did the impulse towards drama, whether it be writing or directing, come from?
A high school teacher. My middle brother, my older brother, was supposed to be the writer in the family. Mm-hmm. So you know how as siblings, if you're the youngest one, like the eldest brother was an athlete. Mm-hmm. He was kind of the jock.
Right.
And then Carl was the intellect. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's quite brilliant. He was going to be the writer. Originally, I thought I wanted to go into politics. And it's an interesting thing about this. I found out I have such bad stage fright, like when I act, it's terrifying. But I have such bad stage fright that to this day, when I speak in front of an audience, I actually black out.
Blackout how?
I don't remember what I'm saying.
So you just spoke at, like, Victory Gardens.
I have no idea what I said.
Holy moly.
I'm so terrified. The first day of class is bad, too, and then I get past it. And then I just concentrate on looking people in the eye. But because I did that, like, in junior high, I could speak in public because I would just go to some other place. I know this sounds kind of insane, doesn't it? Anyway,
well, I mean, for a person who is like clearly, I mean, for your audience, now your students, you know, you stand in front of students, you work with students, you talk to groups of people all the time.
Right, but a conversation is not the same thing as standing in front of a room or a group.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If I'm having a conversation, I remember that conversation because I'm taking it in.
Right. Okay.
And I'm. My DNA is changing as I'm listening to a writer, or my DNA is changing when a writer brings their work in the room and we're reading it out loud. And I will always remember that. I will remember that first draft. I'll remember subsequent drafts. I actually freak people out that I'll see for the first time in 40 years, and I'll say, ooh, when you were a sophomore, you wrote this play in my advanced undergraduate class, and they will have forgotten the play, but in a very strange way, I think my memory is formed by witnessing theater and by listening to people's drafts.
This is a superpower.
I don't think it's how I remember people. I mean, it's just, it programs my memory.
So your memory of a person is implanted, associated with...
That's right.
...this other thing.
That's right.
Okay.
Or we're in a rehearsal, or I see them on stage, or we're having a conversation. I'll remember people after I've had a conversation.
Right.
I'll remember faces. I actually don't forget faces, but I can't know what the heck's coming out of my mouth, except that it's from my heart. So I kind of just say, let it go, let it go, let it go. And then next thing I know, I'm stepping off stage and I can breathe again, or I'm back. So
I snap back.
So I thought, well, maybe I'll go into politics because apparently I have no idea what I'm saying, but apparently, you know.
You don't need to know what you're saying.
Well, I mean, I do concentrate, you know, like on here are the thoughts before the blackout happens. But so I really wanted to be the first woman senator in Maryland was my high school ambition. I was class president, all that kind of stuff. And then what happened on the road to becoming a politician and going to law school was I got a crush on a girl and we became lovers. And the second that happened, I thought, I can never run for office. I can never be a politician. I can't be a public person. I can't not be in love with the people I'm in love with, because then something terrible happens. I mean, I was also at times in love with men, but it's like you would never ask someone to give up, unless, of course, they're dedicating themselves to celibacy, give up that degree of intimacy. And I thought, I can't not be true to it. So I immediately just erased the thought of being a politician or going into public service or anything that was public.
Do you think if you were that age today in 2018, it would be different?
I'd be in law school and I'd be thinking about
politics.
Politics or serving some kind of public advocacy. Yeah, I think it's different. I still think that there's, you know, only so far one can go, even after this, you know, I'm here now 50 years after I thought, well, I can't do that. And in truth, which is interesting, there was a lot of hazing going on in theater, particularly in the 70s, but really all the way through to last week. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, when you talk about sexuality, when you talk about race, when you talk about economics, when you talk about identity, when you talk about nationality, when you talk about religion, we can, I don't want to say that we're stuck. We can see strides being made.
Right.
But I do think, Susan Laurie Parks once said to me, that there was a mathematics about when you could become a writer or a playwright. Now, this was maybe 30 years ago. We were at the same writing retreat. And she said, if you're a white, straight man, you can make it by the time you're 25. That wasn't true, actually, but that's what she said. She said,
and well, you can.
But you can.
Maybe not will, but can.
Right, you can. Right. And you can make it by 30 if you're a white gay man. And then she said, and if you're a woman, a straight woman, you can make it late 30s, 40. She said, but if you're a writer of color or you're a gay woman, the mathematics, you have to add another 5 or 10 years. And, you know, I can't remember, we were, you know, I'm a little bit older, but not that much, but it was very interesting. And I don't think at the time I recognized that in a way what we're enforcing in our commercial theater are voices that are critical, regardless, right, of the gender of the writer. And so, but she said that, and I thought, you know what, that's absolutely right. I can do it, but it's going to take longer. And I used to make myself kind of feel better. I hope he won't mind me saying this because I love him so much. I encountered Mack Wellman when I was 27 years old. And I first read his plays. And then for the next 20 or 30 years, I kept thinking, why don't, you know, mainstream American theaters realize how brilliant Mack Wellman is? And he is a straight white guy.
Right.
So in a very funny way, it made me think that it's a more complicated situation that what I guess I'm trying to become at home with is that it's not only my voice that's caused this long and delayed journey, but it's also my pugilistic self.
Right.
At post-play discussions or at panels or saying to artistic directors, well, why can't you do that play? Why aren't you doing this play right? And it's that, whatever it is, persona, which is, you know, the thing that we haven't figured out to do, I think, as a society, is to allow ourselves to have prodigal daughters.
Okay.
And prodigal sons are something that you expect.
It's a given.
As a given for men who are playwrights or writers.
Sure.
That you're a prodigal son. And I very much feel like I am a prodigal daughter. And in the same way that it took a while for women to be comedians, or, you know, I think of Wanda Sykes, you know, and I'm wondering if there's a mathematics of becoming stand-up comics that Susan Laurie Parks would kind of delineate here.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That I think primarily we look towards particularly Arthur Miller's or David Mamet's
mm-hmm.
to be our prodigal sons.
Mm-hmm.
A little harder if you're Tennessee Williams. You kind of get the crap beaten out of you. Little more delayed.
And then not until after he's gone, where he's referred to as like a voice of...
That's right.
The American playwright.
That's right. Instead of, you know, the wisecrack, I'm trying to remember if it was Mary McCarthy, someone wrote when they saw either Glass Menagerie or Streetcar Named Desire, that there was the scent of cheap perfume after someone has left the room in terms of his work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a queer bashing, you know, that he went through.
Mm.
So, you know, I don't really have any explanation. And I can't really see my own voice or why this delay. I mean, because a lot of people pretty much this year were going, okay, you know, you were 65 when you got done on Broadway. The truth of the matter is I had always thought when I formed the playwriting programs that I wanted to make sure or to see that the writers I worked with got to Broadway before I did, or that I would go through, like I've never been done at Lincoln Center. I've never been done at the Goodman, except when Baltimore Waltz was done. But after that, but I have to say, I've had so many writers I love done at Lincoln Center or done at the Goodman or done at the Public. Who knows? It's when it's the right time to go through the door, you go through the door.
So I've been obsessed with this concept of success and having this engaging with playwrights about how they see success
right.
and how they measure it.
Right.
And you have consistently lived these parallel lives of educator and playwright
right.
simultaneously. And going back to what Susan Laurie Parks said to you about 30 years ago, so you were in your mid to late 30s at the time.
Right.
Did you, at that point, had you felt like you were a success as a playwright? Or were you feeling like success was in the future or even possible?
I don't know that I do feel success as a playwright. I think that what saved me was loving the plays that I was hearing in the room. And what saved me are things like, you know, Nilo Cruz asked me to come to Anna and the Tropics on Broadway, you know. Or that Kiara called me from backstage the night of the Tonys.
Mm.
Things like that,
mm-hmm.
where you think, I'm getting through the door. I mean, in a way, I feel in a kind of collectivity with writers and artists. You know, it's not that I'm going to get through the door. It's that we're getting through the door.
So you feel it vicariously through your students?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I also, but that there's another... side to that, which is I go insane at the delay in their careers. And this is where I probably got myself in trouble with a lot of artistic directors.
Well, because this is your own personal experience, right? Like, you're recognizing the delay in others because
That's right.
you felt the delay yourself.
Oh, absolutely. But I know that it works. And it works in the room. And it's a brilliant play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an important play.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it can be done because I produced it on $100
mm-hmm.
with 2 weeks of rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know how the audience responded. So I want to know why, for example, Origin Story by Dan LaFranc has never been produced.
Mm-hmm.
It is incredible in terms of things it has to teach me about gender. Extraordinary. Absolute brilliance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have a long list of brilliant, brilliant plays. Now, obviously, playwrights who remain keep going, go on, and those drafts either get done after one play gets through the door and then the earlier plays get done, or they just move on and they leave them in the drawer. And my question is, how do we as a society sustain the journey? For me, the journey was sustained and had to be sustained by running a program and teaching 60 to 80 hours a week. A, it made me forget that I couldn't get my own plays produced, or that, you know, I would get maybe one production a year.
Mm-hmm.
B, I needed health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
I would never be able to survive without health insurance. And C, it gave me this incredible circle of younger colleagues that really ripped my assumptions apart. Do you know what I mean? Really kicked my dramaturgical butt by doing things on the page that then we could perform on $100.
But what was happening to your artistic life from that decision point you had where you were like, I cannot be in politics, I'm going to go in this direction? What was happening in your artistic life from that point to the point where you were running a program? Because we're talking about a really long period of time, right?
Yeah, so I applied to Yale and didn't get in. And that was the only way, that was the only school I knew where you could apply to be a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
And I tracked that class very closely that got in. It was Wendy Wasserstein, Christopher Durang, and Albert Inurato. And for a long time I didn't hear, and a lot of friends were like, oh, you're going to get in, you're
mm-hmm,
going to get in.
Mm-hmm.
So didn't happen. And, you know, I knew in my family, for a woman in my family, this meant that I would probably type my way up to some kind of administrative assistant, you know, government job. And I frankly had more fun, although I wouldn't say more fun, but I would go back and forth. Is it better to work in the factory? Is it better to work in this plumbing company as their temp secretary, and go back and forth? And I thought, I've got to think of a way out. So at the last moment, I'm not even sure why or how, I applied for a doctoral program in theater
mm-hmm.
at Cornell University.
Mm-hmm.
And I got in. Now, this is the other thing. I was very terrified to pick up the phone. I was very scared. I could assert myself about issues I was angry about, but to push myself forward was almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow or other, I had the courage to call the chair of the program when I got in, but they didn't give me any money.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way in hell I could go to the school. So I managed to get my courage up, and I called him, and I said, I would love to come. I cannot pay for this. And right on the spur, he said, we can cover your tuition. Can you make your own living?
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately said, I type 80 words per minute. That's
mm-hmm.
what I remember, thinking, thank God my mother made me take that typing class. And so I went to Cornell And I typed, and I did, you know, every odd job I could find. But fortunately, two things. I had friends who showed me how to dumpster dive. And if I will never eat a stir fry again in my life. I just dumpster dove for you know, a couple of years. And secondly, after I became eligible, once upon a time in this country, you could be a graduate student and get food stamps. If you stayed in school for a year. Isn't that amazing? Under Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
That's how we supported all of that support for education and accessibility to education.
Right, and the cost was just so much lower as well. So what were you writing in this time period?
So I mean, it kind of blew my mind. This guy who taught theory became, I thought I was going to go into theater history, and the guy who let me in had wanted to be a playwright, and he taught theory. His name was Bert States. And he offered a playwriting class, so I took the playwriting class. And, you know, I had been writing musical spoofs. That's what I was writing, putting them in my drawer, or really bad plays and putting them in my drawer. And for some reason in his class, I decided to write a play about the daughter of Sir Thomas More called Meg. It was my first year at Cornell. And I remember that Bert, when I brought the pages in, stood up, dashed to the blackboard, and started in chalk, kind of diagramming the structure of the play.
Mm.
And I was astonished. I'm like, wait, who's play is he talking about? Because he had been teaching his semester, he was teaching a semester on Hamlet. It was an entire semester just reading theories of Hamlet.
Right, yeah.
And it turned out by some fluke that there was a brand new competition called the American College Theater Festival.
Right. I know it well.
And Cornell was going to sponsor the regional festival.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was all this huge accident. So Cornell had said yes, and Bert turned around and said, do you want to enter Meg? At that point, we changed the title from A Woman for All Reasons to Meg. He said, we should put in an entry. And I went, okay. And we had an MFA program. Robert Schenken at the time was an amazing MFA actor. And we cast some undergrads. And I never knew what the hell happened. It won. And so all of a sudden, you know, like opening a Cracker Jack box, I have a 3-year William Morris agency contract.
It
was the prize. If you won the American College Theater Festival, you got an agent. And, of course, this guy was right out of the mailroom.
Yeah, of course, right, but still.
Samuel French published you. I think I got maybe 5 productions of this play. And I have to tell you, I mean, if I could find this play and all of the copies and burn it at this point, I really, really would. But you know,
at the time,
you know, by the time this happened, I was 24. I mean, it was like the year in school. And, you know, I guess if somebody brought in Meg, I'd go, you know, stick to it. But at any rate, my agent said, where's your next play? And I was in this graduate program taking my exams, you know, and that's like you're reading 40 hours a week in addition to your graduate courses.
Right, yeah.
And the good news and the bad news is that I was a woman in 1976 because Cornell did not give fellowships in this program to women. Because it would be wasted on us because we were going to get married and have children.
Right, what are you going to do with the rest of your
exactly,
life?
Exactly, right. So how can you give a fellowship to a woman? So the program said, we can give you a teaching assistantship. So on top of the exams and the graduate papers and all of that, I got my first intro to theater course. which became this unbelievable passion where I spent probably 40 hours a week with freshmen, you know. So in love with being in class that I would run home and just kind of fall into a coma, just being so jazzed from it. And I wrote this second play, Desdemona, and the male faculty just were, they were up in arms. It was already getting a little dicey because of my feminism, because of my lesbianism. I mean, Bert was always supporting my intellect, but he did, I mean, he did sit down and tell me what I think any advisor would say at that point in time. You have to make a choice. Either you become a writer or you become a scholar, and you can't do both. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, I really love the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think of myself as a playwright, and it's not anything I thought I could do.
Despite winning an award and getting all of this stuff.
Fluke.
You didn't think at that point, this is a thing I can do.
No, and at Desdemona, so shocked every member of my graduate committee. And I mean, I got... when I did readings of that play, like, you are not a well woman. like, really angry comments. And I thought, okay. So I went on full steam ahead in my graduate career.
And were you believing the bullshit that they were telling you?
I kind of did. I kind of thought, I can't take personally being told that I hate men,
yeah,
to my face, and that I'm sick. I mean, people were just telling me to my face I was sick. You're a sick woman.
Right.
Women don't write like this, et cetera, and so forth. And I just thought, I love the teaching. I went ahead with my thesis. I asked if I could do a thesis and the new field of feminist theater, and they said, you'll never get a job. So I thought, well, I'll choose something that I initially hate and I'll learn to love it, which happened. And so I chose a thesis about restoration comedies.
Oh, wow.
And I spent 3 years reading every restoration comedy. There are over 300. And I wrote a thesis called Hiding Scenes in Restoration Comedies, which was all about how women were being used in a warfare between men in this period in English drama. And so there were all of these lovers, you know, sleeping, usually cavalier upper class lovers sleeping with Puritan wives.
Uh-huh.
You know, it really was the revolution going on in the drama. And at the time it was I was being promoted in terms of my teaching, and at the time that they said, listen, if you turn this in, we're going to put you on an assistant professorship, my entire three committee members retired and resigned at the same time. They kind of gave up on the department, which I don't blame them.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, their political enemies became my committee members in the English department, who took the thesis and said, start all over. And I'd spent 3 years, and I said, I wrote this for Bert States.
Mm-hmm.
And the English department chair said something nasty about Bert States, and then they said, are you going to start all over and rewrite a new one? And I said, I can't. And they said, you have 24 hours to pack up your office.
Holy shit.
So I left Ithaca, I want to say maybe 1980, 81. I can't even remember. It was really trauma.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting when we're in this moment of time talking about traumatic memory. There are things that have happened in academia and actually in early theater that's such a traumatic memory that I can't quite remember the time. That feels like a bashing. I went to New York. I thought I'm an ABD. Mm-hmm. I did three jobs. I was a secretary for American Place Theater for Wynne Hanmond. I worked for the New York State Council on the Arts. I did kind of under the table factory work. I got illegal sublets. I wrote in Baby Makes Seven, and then a lot of people told me how sick I was. I mean, literally. Like, I remember a woman who was an agent said, I wouldn't pay $40 to see this play, I wouldn't pay $20, and I wouldn't see it for free. You are a sick woman. I mean, I was getting letters like that. And I was getting really kind of hostile encounters. There's a gentleman that is a colleague of ours now, and every now and then I'll remember his name. Starting at age 27, I tried to become a member of New Dramatists. You know, something.
Right, right.
I submitted every year to the O'Neill. And the guy in an interview told me that I had to learn how to dress better. Now, I do have to tell you also that I didn't buy clothing in a store until I got hired as an assistant professor at Brown University. So, you know, he's absolutely right. I'm wearing Salvation Army. But he basically told me, which I was told in grad school, too, how to dress like a woman. That if I didn't dress like a woman, I was not going to be treated with respect. So I wouldn't say that... I'm not even sure why I held on, except that I think I have this kind of gutter rat mentality, which is, if you slam the door in my face, I'm going to embarrass you by standing outside this door. Which is why I kept applying to New Dramatists. They let me in when I was 45 after I wrote and how I Learned to Drive. I applied.
You got into New Dramatists after How I Learned to Drive.
That's correct. None of this is Todd London's fault. It was the admissions process.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Someone was voting me down every year. They didn't change their admissions committee. I think I have a notion who it was. But someone who obviously thought that I didn't act like a woman should act, and therefore, and I wasn't writing women's plays or whatever. I mean, literally, it's amazing. I mean, in your 20s, the things that people say to you, I mean, I'm quite... If people say, you know, you seem so nice now, or you seem very kind, I've worked with people who say, do you ever get angry? Now, obviously, I'm very angry when I'm talking about issues. Wait until I hear a young artist or a young student.
I see it. I mean,
you treated badly.
You've completely laid out this whole delay in where this comes from.
Right.
Oh, my God. I don't even know what to say.
Well, I mean, now, look. The question is how do we make whatever this process in shorter? Because there are some reasons that when I started in the 70s, that there was this gap. And one of the reasons is that there were fewer not-for-profits and there were fewer small little theater companies.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we've seen in the last 50 years, thank God, is the rise of smaller and medium theaters. You know, when I was starting out, it was Manhattan theater clubs,
mm-hmm.
Where you really have to worry about paying for the real estate. I mean, and I've come to a point now, and God knows, you know, after I did a tweet a while ago about Manhattan Theater Club not choosing any women for a season, and then the next year there were women, I think Lynn Meadow has been fighting the good fight. She's kept that building open.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing playwrights like Frances Koig, Suni Koig. I'm sorry, I'm having a brain fart. She was an undergrad of mine. She did Lidless. She's brilliant.
Right.
Yes, Frances Chu Koig. Thank you. I'm having a senior moment. You know, I am now at peace that Lynn is never going to produce me because for the most viable reason of all. She doesn't like my work. Why should anybody, why should I ask someone not to be an artist? You have to be an artist as an artistic director and only do work that you believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And so my age colleagues and peers didn't believe or like my work. Why should they do me? I mean, one of the interesting things is that I'm now being mentored by younger colleagues as artistic directors, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's a sort of the question like, how can my colleagues not do Mack Wellman? Well, they didn't get him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a 25-year-old will get Mack. It's that sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually a gap, if this makes sense, in my generation, that because we didn't have enough structures, multiple structures, for new plays and theater, and because we didn't have, and we still don't have enough, diversity in terms of women, people of color, trans, different ways to produce collaborative ensemble theater structures,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That look, I mean, I'm in Chicago talking to you right now, for God's sake, you know, where there's the neo-futurist and there's, you know, now we're kind of nostalgic about Anne Bogart, thank God, that, you know, there's the City Company, but that was revolutionary when she started. Do you know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
We've come to a point where there's a lot more different voices responding to different voices versus you go to school, your parents somewhat underwrite your education, you have family, friends, and you get your internship, which you may possibly be able to afford because your parents are going to pay the rent on your apartment. Now, that's still a very common story. It's a common story for people who are nominated to the Supreme Court.
Sure.
Right? But the question is, how many theaters now have educational programs or have ways of trying to make the doorway more accessible?
Sure. How many voices, how many plays have not been written, how many playwrights have not become because they didn't have parents who could subsidize their education?
That's right. That's right. You know, and my old line, which is true, is that when I came home and told my mom I was going to theater, she sat Shiva on the sofa because, you know, I was the first generation to go to college. She wanted me to go to law school. With my mind, I could be a lawyer.
So you essentially had to come out in two ways to your family.
I've come out in multiple ways to my family. And actually, I think all of us in this moment in time have to come out on a daily basis, whether it's coming out as an artist, coming out sexually or in terms of your identity, coming out politically, coming out in terms not only of all of the facets of your own identity, but the facets of the identities of the people you love.
Mm-hmm.
And this means, and it's exhausting, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get in a cab and somebody says something, you get into a cab, someone makes a joke, and you have to say, excuse me. Right? So, yes. It was an interesting experience and a journey in terms of my family.
Mm-hmm.
It made no sense. I wouldn't say my mother supported me in any facet of my identity. My brother Carl did. When I finally got back in touch with my mother right before I won the Pulitzer with How I Learned to Drive, I said, Mom, you told me I was going to starve, and look, How I Learned to Drive is running in a theater for a year. And she said, yeah, and if you take all of the royalties that you've earned in your lifetime and look at all the hours you've spent, you're making under minimum wage.
Let's
talk about success. Because
yeah.
What do I feel successful about? I feel incredibly successful. I have never been bored a day of my life since I walked into a drama class my freshman year in high school. Now, how many people can say that?
Not many. Not many are able to maintain a career for this long. You know, eventually people seem to burn out or find motivation in another direction or fall into film and television.
And that's not falling now.
I have to tell you.
I mean, yes, yeah. but I have to say that I really think now of television and film as being dramatic writing,
mm-hmm.
and that we've moved much closer to the British model, in which you are a playwright, you write for film, you write for TV. Over there, you write for the BBC Radio Hour.
Mm-hmm.
God wish we had that here. But I want to say that one of the things that I really loved the opportunity to do, and it caused some flashback from my colleagues, was once I got the opportunity to run and design a program in playwriting, what was, you know, it's not that I feel like I have anything to...
And this is Brown.
This was Brown.
Right.
It's not that I feel like I have anything to teach. It's more that I'm kind of running the workshop in a peer education. But what I do have is saying to every playwright who crossed my path, okay, this is how you write your bio. This is how you write a resume. This is what a CV looks like. Here's how you write a cover letter. Let me see your cover letter. Now, every rejection letter you get, you bring to me, and I'm going to do an interpretive dance. And I'm going to tell you that if you got a Xerox, it means you didn't get past the first reader.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody said, "Dear Brian, we've read your play," actually the literary manager read you, and you got past two readers, and the literary manager read you and liked the play, and he's actually writing you by name. And if you get a, "Dear Brian, we're so sorry we can't do your play, may we hold on to it, there are many, many plays, when you're coming through Chicago, would you please call us, we'd love to have coffee," you've made it up into the upper 10%, and the artistic director looked at your play. And one of the things I didn't realize until I started running a program was, what's the first thing you should do? What your grandmother taught you to do. You take the name of that person who signed the letter. First of all, now this is in the days when we had letters, you wet your finger and you run it over the signature.
See if it was actual ink.
And if the ink runs, you've had a really good day.
Yeah.
And the first thing you do is you sit down and you say, "Dear Tanya Palmer, thank you so much for taking the time to write me. I realize there are many, many plays on your desk, so thank you for your encouragement. I would very much like to send you my next play. It is called Desdemona," right? Or, and then if they say, "Meet us for coffee," find a way to sleep on somebody's sofa bed.
Yeah.
And go there and do the and take them up on the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Within 7 years, even if they may not like your work and not do you, but in 7 years, you're a colleague.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it seems to me when you say not everyone can sustain a career, I actually disagree. There are ways, if we're smart enough to write plays, there are ways we can put together jobs that are still in the theater. A lot of my colleagues when I started teaching went, "Oh, well, you're not a playwright because you're an assistant professor."
Mm-hmm.
And I heard this from a lot of theater artists. Excuse me. I'm even more of a theater artist because I'm working with names that you'll only know 5 or 10 years from now, and I know them now. So who's on the inside, right? So it's this kind of attitude, like, you know, after school programs. I started a program in women's maximum security. I'm like, look, there's a Jewish community center here. What about working with veterans? What about working with senior citizens? What about learning to do a grant proposal? Did you know that every state has grant writing workshops? They're free. And I told people how to find money, how to find the right agent, how to find colonies, how to find teaching jobs, five little, you know, job letters. This is all still sort of in my head, although it's aging rapidly.
I took a two-day boot camp from you maybe 5 years ago.
Right.
5 or 6 years ago at USC.
Right. Whoever brought me in.
There was something that I referred to the very beginning of our conversation to you having a superpower with regard to memory, and you're like, that's just memory. And you're right. But when I met you for this weekend in a room full of, I don't know, 40 people, I recognize that you have an innate ability to know the people in the room with you.
Yeah.
I stood up and said something. I don't remember what I said in that room, but I spoke to you one-on-one for the first time, and I felt like you knew me. You understood me. And I have referred to that as Paula Vogel's superpower. And so when you talk about when you were developing this program and you are teaching people how to write CVs and letters and how to respond, there's something else to your teaching which is very human and emotional and heartfelt. And I've been trying to find that in myself for other people. Very curious where this comes from, if you can recognize it in yourself.
I know you were surprised I remembered you.
I am
when I walked into the lobby.
I'm completely surprised. I thought you were being polite.
No. No, it's I think it's perfect. I think it's absolutely selfish of me. I need to know that this thing that I have loved, I mean really have loved since I've been 15, is going to continue. I really need to know that. And I also, I would not have taught if, people are always saying, oh, my God, the people you've taught. I'm like, you know what? Everybody's teaching extraordinary people. Are mentors taking the time, right, to say, you can do this. You know, you're going to have to develop your own toolkit, but here are the different ways to do it, right? In the same way that a really great, great, someone who loves actors. I mean, I love playwrights. It's not just that I love the field. I love playwrights. I love reading the first draft of a play. I can't tell you. I love actors. I love being in the room. I started as a stage manager. That's what I thought I'd be. And then I realized I didn't have the nerves when something went wrong during the run of a show.
Right.
And I thought, oh, my God, you've got to be like, you've got to have triage skills.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Like in 90, critical care
to be
able
90 things to be a stage manager.
To be a stage manager. Yeah. I can't make it. I mean, it was really sad because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in the room. I wanted to take care of everybody's process. I wanted to see out of these pages and these different people an actual world come into being. I thought that was the most phenomenal thing in the world. Really great acting teachers who are very beloved are there saying things like, you know, you can do books on tape. You know, here's how you do voiceovers. Okay, here's how you write all of your skill sets, how to put it together so that it is part of the theatrical process. Yes, you can write cable. Yes, you can be on a staff. I got to tell you, I hope all of my writers are remembering me. I'm kind of tracking the shows they're on. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And most importantly, for me to be able to say at this moment in time, as a woman of the 70s, yes, you can also have the life. You're going to have to work at it, that you choose. You want children? You want to have children? You want to have a home? You want a relationship and a partnership, marriage, whatever that is going to fuel and feed you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you want to be a member of the community. And look, it's a balancing act. But I'm here just going, you know, thank God, all I did was run a program for 60, 80 hours a week, and I'm not a parent. Because I'm talking to people who've had, mm-hmm. you know, or having children we were like thinking, wow, only 60 hours? Do you know what I mean?
So yeah.
Even parenting skills are things that help the mentorship inside the field that fuel the artistic, not even, mostly, fuel the artistic process. So I don't know why or where this love came from being in a very domestically violent family, from not having kind of parenting and trying to find the home. This is usually, right, a theme that I think runs through a lot of artists, that we can choose this particular family. It is usually a safe zone, although, again, we really have to be vigilant, because there are many, many theaters that are not providing safe zones. But by and large, that exhilaration of being in the group is something that's lifelong.
Something I'm learning in this moment is you, as I'm getting to know you and your story, is that you are constantly looking for in other people the thing that you yearned for yourself when you were growing up.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I think that may be a parenting instinct. You know, I certainly, being privileged now to watch different generations of my family and former students, just seeing that kind of resolve, that it must be a human resolve. Not all humans have it. It's going to be better for my kids. Mm. I'm going to make this better for my kids.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to make it a better world. I don't want them to struggle. I don't want them to hurt. I don't want them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what we expect. I think some of the difficulties we are all having in this moment of time is that instinct for good parenting, which I don't consider it family values. I consider it community values. I actually do think of any child I see on the street as my child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my family. Or, you know, is that kid all right? Why are they, you know, in the street? Why are they crying? And you keep the way that we do in neighborhoods, right?
Yeah.
And somewhere along the way, there's been a dwindling of our empathy.
Yeah, there's a huge empathy gap now.
And I do associate it with the Republican Party. I do associate it with a white, upper middle class 1% thinking of society as an oligarchy, as theirs instead of ours,
mm-hmm.
And a kind of rise of selfishness. And, you know, for me, it's not that it's always that. Those impulses are always in our society. For me, I date it to 1980 and the election of Reagan. So it's so interesting now to see him being held up as an empathic president. But what is the one thing that we know grows empathy? The artistic process.
Mm-hmm.
Every child participating in whether it's music, painting, theater, any arts process is the way that we as children learn empathy.
And the problems that you just talked about that we have in society have been mirrored in the leadership of theater over the years, which seems to be changing in this moment. But who knows if this, do you think this change, this time the change seems real? Are we really shifting our trajectory?
I want to believe that we are in the worst last gasp of white supremacy, that the reason, I guess I didn't expect that the backlash was going to be this extreme,
mm-hmm.
from Barack Obama. And I feel in many, many ways somewhat naive, but I do think that demographics and time is on the side of empathy, of community, of different cultural values. You know, I don't want to say, you know, hurry up, but at my point in time, I feel like I shouldn't be running programs. I shouldn't be going and taking writers' retreats. That space is needed for younger artists. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, give ourselves a sabbatical, give ourselves a retirement, help in whatever ways you can, but step back.
But as somebody who is still creating, and you're going to be creating for as long as you can, how do you still find that artistic support?
That was me knocking on wood. Well, the truth of the matter is that in terms of the artistic support, I guess I'm right now I'm lucky because of Indecent. So people are coming forward, you know, for the first time in a couple of years saying, do you have anything new? I'm aware that there's now kind of a new invisibility with age, but that's fine to something else that I can kind of rail against. I do feel that I have the means because I've had so many collaborators. There's nothing that stops me from writing a play and asking people into my living room the same way I did when I was 27. I'll bring the pizza and I'll bring the beer. Will you come and show up and read the first draft, which is actually how we did the first draft of Indecent in the living room. So, you know, I actually have that. But, for example, getting, like, there's this wonderful place, Hedgebrook, that is for women writers. Getting a space in Hedgebrook, I'm constantly asking people, do you apply to writers' colonies? Many of these are free. They provide you with three meals a day. Even if you can only get the flu for 2 weeks, take off the day job, right? That makes a critical, crucial difference. For myself, having taught for so long and having stored up, as you now know I do, all the voices of the writers that I've watched, what I told myself is I would quit my day job and I would respond to those voices. So as I'm writing the new plays now, and I'm working on three plays this year, I am literally having conversations back. It's an extraordinary gift that the writers have given me. And I'm hoping, and I'm just saying this, you know, it's been a very delayed... You know, this is the first time I've worked in Chicago. This past week. First time I've worked in Chicago. I'm hoping I'll be the Grandma Moses, you know, of playwriting. I'm ready for it. And if not, I go back to this. What is the definition of success was the question you asked.
Right.
The definition of success for me is to never be bored a day in my life. And therefore, I must talk back to the writers who have constantly stimulated me.
Well, you're a writer who has constantly stimulated me since I started to write. And I'm so thankful for this moment that you've given me. And
thank you.
And I'm glad that we're able to record this and share this with lots of other people. And I hope they get as much out of it.
And I mean, thank you for just spending this time in terms of making the conversations for the podcast. Because that's... All of these podcasts now, like I can go and hear Mike Liu, you know, that kind of thing, or, you know, Antoinette,
yeah.
You know, and the abilities that somewhere, someone who is in high school yeah. can hear Antoinette.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Is huge as a gift to the field.
And you talked before about how you can't always maybe have a play produced, but you can be a part of the field.
That's right.
And that's the thing that keeps me going. Because, you know, I am writing and scratching and clawing, but I can't control how the universe responds to
that's
the play.
Right.
But I can contribute, and that's sort of what keeps this going.
And you really are. So I need to thank you for
thank
that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. It was good talking to you.
I appreciate talking to you, too.
Thank you, Paula. Really, just thank you. I also want to thank Ramsey Carey from the Goodman Theater in Chicago for helping to make this episode possible. And thank you to the Goodman for allowing us to record in your wicked, swanky VIP lounge. Thanks, as always, to the awesome folks at American Theater Magazine for the continued life of the subtext. The magazine has a couple other podcasts you should definitely check out. Go to americantheater.org and look for Three on the Isle and Token Theater Friends. These podcasts are made by some of the most brilliant theater minds in America. I also want to shout out a couple other podcasts with no connection to American Theater Magazine. The first is The Context, a podcast on dramaturgy hosted by Kate Langsdorf. I like them because they pair well with the subtext. The other podcast is Masters of the Stage Regional Originals, presented by SDC Foundation and hosted by an excellent director, M. Graham Smith. Check out all of those podcasts and fill your brain with more theater. The music at the beginning was Home at Last by John Bartman. The theme song for the subtext is High by International Pen Pal. You can reach us on Twitter at Subtext Podcast. You can email us, thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. I usually end these episodes with an attempt to be funny or clever, and I decided I want to change that up. I regularly listen to the podcast Code Switch, and they end their episodes with a song that is giving them life at the moment. I like that. So I'm co-opting it. Sort of. I'm going to start ending episodes sharing the title of a play that is filling me up at the moment. This month, the play that is filling me up is Laramie Project by Moises Kaufman and Tectonic Theater. It has been 20 years since Matthew Shepard's murder, and I just shared this play with a group of students, most of whom were not even born yet. I thought it was important to remember. Pick up Laramie Project if you don't know it. Take another look if you do.